This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 205 for Wednesday, August 24th, 2016. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me tonight, for the first time in quite a while, Mr. Brockett Vola of Biggest Fan Podcast. How's your summer going, man?
Well, it's going well. I immediately, my instinct was to talk about the weather and everything, and I'm like, crap, I'm not going to do it. Every time I say, no geography, no weather, don't talk to Joel about it. I also thought, you know what, maybe I'll talk to Joel about where I live in Canada if Donald Trump wins the presidency in the United States. I'm like, nope, no politics, no geography. I'm like, I'm not going to do it. And I told Joel before the show started, I have a lot of energy tonight. And absolutely nothing to talk about. So I have prepared some things, but generally, you're going to see just how much of an off-the-cuff morning zoo host I can be with whatever topic comes to mind. And I'm also trying out a different weird cocktail that I threw together before the show. So that's probably aiding some of it.
What are you drinking?
We recently tried to kill a bottle of tequila, which is Laura and I's probably lowest alcohol. Mm-hmm. Generally it seems like somebody's like, I love whiskey, hate tequila, love tequila, hate whiskey. Gin's kind of tossed about. And I, for some strange reasons, some people can't handle vodka. Like, vodka to me is probably the most like baseline, like that goes in so many fruity drinks.
Yeah.
You're probably more alert. You're probably more reacting to like the sugar content than you are the vodka. But
yeah.
So I got some tequila I'm trying to kill, and I got some fresh limes because I wanted to add some color, going back to the summer vibe. So I've tried to make some colorful drinks, and one of which I kind of mixed some San Pellegrino flavored water, sort of slightly carbonated waters, but not sodas. Mm-hmm. One had like a pomegranate orange and grapefruit. I mixed a little bit of those in there with some fresh lime and tequila, and that I called a swart. S-W-A-R-T, because it's sweet and tart. It was nice. Very good. And tonight, I really went out on a limb and put a shot of tequila. This is about in a tumbler, or a small like scotch tumbler, really. very elegant. I added a shot of just white tequila, and then I put 2 quarter limes, both completely squeezed, and Sunkiss, which is just orange soda. And then I splashed in, and the most random thing, I don't know if you have these in Canada, Joel, but the water flavorings, which are kind of like in these tiny squirt bottles.
Have you seen those? Yes. Yeah, I think I've seen them. Not everywhere, okay. But yeah, we do have them.
Okay. Well, in America, we're always looking for the next like absolutely backwards product, like, oh, I have water at this restaurant, but I will squirt crap from my purse into it.
I've never understood the whole flavored water thing. I'm one of those people that I just like water.
I love water. Like, my wife does not. So
okay,
that's where I got introduced to them. And this one is a particularly insane, decadent American choice, the Arizona Tea, which is a brand of like flavored tea, which you can usually get in cans or bottles. Mm-hmm. Pretty much like, I guess, sort of like Nest Tea you can see in bottles and stuff like that. But it's really, really pretty much like the super cheap stuff you would find. They came up with a a flavoring called Mucho Mango. It's essentially just mango flavored like sugar juice. And I did a slight squeeze of that on top of the orange soda, 2 quarters lime, and tequila. And I got to be honest, at first it was a little, okay. But then once the ice, my giant ice cube, melted and kind of mix the flavorings together. It's kind of nice. So I don't know if it's a combination of my energy and the fact that work has been a real drag, or my lack of tolerance for tequila, but this drink is actually seems to be hitting me pretty much in all the right places, nice. Which is all you could really ask for.
It's growing on you. It's growing on you. I don't know much about bartending. I actually, funny fact, I didn't drink until I was about 28, 27. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I've since gone into a space where very quickly I've advanced to the hard stuff. Like I like beer, but I like craft beer, strong beer. I prefer dark, heavy red wines like Merlots and stuff over white wines and things like that. And I like scotch and I like smoky scotch. I like rum. None of these are like, I don't mix any of this with anything. I like dark rum, just straight. I don't even want ice cubes.
It's really good.
Couple drops of water. I'm not sure if you guys have it down there. It's called Gosling's Family Reserve. It's about a $75 bottle of rum. So it's a special occasion, kind of Christmassy thing. Mm-hmm. And it comes in a box. Like it's got wax melted over the top of it and it's shipped in like a pine box with wood shavings and stuff in it. And it's amazing. I mean, you pour it into a rum glass and you swirl it around and you can see like it's almost like liquid candy just kind of rolling around in the glass. And it's amazing. And the last time I had that was when I was first playing through Assassin's Creed Black Flag. So I had a couple glasses of rum being a pirate. I mean, it was perfect. It was a great Christmas vacation. But a lot of that kind of stuff I tend to buy myself on special occasions and things like that. And I bought a bottle of Tomatin, which is a scotch, supposed to be kind of middle of the road, but I missed, the guy at the liquor commission that I talked to gave me some not great advice. And, it was finished in a sherry cask, which gave it kind of a cherry sweeter finish, which I don't like. Anything that's got a sweet finish in hard alcohol like that, like a scotch or a brandy, I find takes like cough syrup. Like it just, especially if it's not a really nice bourbon or if you don't go all the way, then it just ends up tasting like cough medicine. So I've been in the market for a new bottle of scotch, and I don't remember where it is. And let me see if I can bring this up really fast, because it was Mike O'Day that was talking to me about it the other day. But he knows that I like Beaumont. Lafroig, Lofraig. The names of these scotches is insane. Anyway, if you like Beaumont like I do, then apparently Lafroig is another good scotch. I hesitate to buy bottles that I've not tried. That was my issue with Tomatin. Now with Beaumont, I had tried at a friend's place. Glenmorangie was a gift from my father. And he and I tend to have similar tastes, but yeah, like I'm looking for a new bottle, but it's like, I don't want to just go buy another bottle of Beaumont because I've had that before.
Right.
I kind of want to stretch my legs. So Scotch Night in Halifax is Wednesdays and I'm always on the show. So I need to find a Wednesday where I'm not swamped to go out for Scotch Night. I think there might be a Sunday night somewhere, but I've been to the Sunday night one, and their Scotch list is not really long. But the Loose Cannon and the Foggy Goggle are two spots here in town, and I've been there, and they do have rather long Scotch lists. And what's nice about Scotch Night is, like, sometimes a really nice Scotch will run you $9 or $12, you know, for a glass when you're out trying it. But they do it for $5.
Ooh,
on Scotch Night. I don't think they do the 12 years. They certainly don't do the 15, or not, sorry, not the 12 years. They don't do the 18 years that are like regular $12 or $15 for a glass, which is crazy when you think about how much you're paying for a drop
for
of alcohol.
Much ounce. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, around here, I mean, it's an ounce, but it's a Nova Scotia ounce. It depends on what bar you go to. have you ever actually poured an ounce of scotch into a glass? It makes your heart hurt.
Because a standard shot or I guess two jiggers is about 2 ounces, so you're really not even getting
I mean I've got a couple of scotch glasses here, and I go by fingers. Like I use one finger.
I love fingers.
Up from the bottom of the, it's just enough, you know, like you just, you know, I'll have one, it's good. If I have two, If I have three, I'm going to go to bed shortly thereafter. but yeah, I just now. Do you when you drink your drinks? Do you do rocks? Do you do mixes with rum? Like what, or do you do straight?
Oh, with rum itself, I have. Oh, one of my very good friends, Adam Cobb, loves rum. That's his number one, and he loves dark rum, you know. And I for a very long time, probably my favorite is the Dark and Stormy. That's my absolute favorite of the rums. So I'm familiar with Gosling's because of Gosling's dark rum and Gosling's ginger beer. Mm-hmm. Of all the ones I could probably do straight, I think rum would be up there. Oddly enough, I'm backtracking a bit, but I think the one thing I couldn't do straight is vodka. Like like the big brawny Russian man who just sits there and just drinks vodka like over and over again. Like I'm like, geez. Like I could even see just sipping like gin, even though to me, gin doesn't really have. I'm biggest fan. We've done like Liquor Week and. Oh. When we talked about the different liquors, it was like spend your money to get the better whiskeys. You can spend your money to get certain better tequilas and certain better rums. But as far as vodka and gin is concerned, for the most part, any mid-tier is going to be just as good as the high tiers. If you get like gut bottom of anything, usually gut bottom vodka is going to be the absolute most bitter, but it's slightly tolerable, but of all things, really, 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 really bottom gin. Now, again, I'm saying this as somebody who's only dabbled with gin, but it's not a hardcore gin drinker. You can usually kind of get away with that Wells gin most of the time. Also, because most people are going to put gin in a gin and tonic, which is just going to kill the flavor of it. But if you want like a straight, good martini, you should probably at least get a mid-tier gin. But
I enjoy a dirty gin martini. That's mine.
Yeah.
My martini.
That's the briny one, right? That's the extra.
Yeah, that's the. It's got extra olives and olive juice in the. It was gin, vermouth, and olive juices. That's the whole
right.
thing, and usually ice, or chips, whatever chips come out of the shaker.
Or if it's the Winston Churchill.
I haven't had a good martini in a long time.
Well, if you get the famous Winston Churchill one, it's you store the gin next to a bottle of vermouth, take the gin away, pour it into a glass, and drink. That's essentially the Winston Churchill martini. Nice. Winston Churchill. God, I love that guy.
Yeah, that's great.
Or at least stories about him.
Yeah. No, I'll do rum straight. I've tried a number of bourbons and I've not fallen in love with them. It seems like the whole hipster crowd right now is just all about bourbon all the time.
Right.
But again, I find that it's probably my price range is not allowing me to buy a $50 bottle of bourbon. Like it is, I'm down in the mid range and I find that they do tend to be very heavy on the cherry. I like rye, which I was introduced to a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Rye and ginger is a nice drink. Simple. But again, you're dealing with a lot of sugar because you got like a ginger ale going in there. And that's why I don't mix because I never keep soda or pop in the house. I don't have a bar. So really, it's just a bottle of straight liquor hanging around. Sometimes I'll buy like a little 500 ml of Coke or something like that and I'll have rum and Coke. And I enjoy brandy because I put brandy in my pudding at Christmas time and there's always brandy left over. I find that when I want a drink to sip, it's usually scotch or a glass of rum. And I'm not like, and that's why I don't like tequila and I don't like, I don't drink tequila and I don't drink vodka because usually that's shots. And I don't do shots.
Right.
Like I've never gone out to get hammered. Like that's never my mission. I go to, socialize, have a good time and relax. So I don't do, like I've done tequila shots at New Year's, but like I do one at midnight and that's it.
Yeah.
I'm done. Then I'm on to dessert, that's the kind of the way it goes. So I'm looking forward to exploring some new scotch stuff. So I'm going to try to get out for a scotch night sometime soon and try some new stuff. I tried a new one earlier this summer called Balwhinnie and I loved it. And of course the reason I loved it is because it's $100 bottle of scotch. It's like, well, okay.
Go.
So I need to find something on a list that doesn't cost a bajillion dollars. So the next time I'm out, I will be looking at the scotch list and I will have my phone open to the NSLC and finding out, okay, what of these are affordable if I actually like
it? I don't do, even though I like whiskey, I don't do a lot of scotch straight. And I haven't yet decided if I can deal with it more on the cold side or room temperature. Mm. But the one time I did have for one of our old employees that was retiring, one of her bucket list items, she's 80 years old. This woman is less than 5 foot, like really, really thin, incredibly sweet woman, only drinks scotch. Mm. It's impressive. And one of her bucket list things was to drink Johnny Walker Blue Label, which if you know anything about the Johnny Walker lines, there's several different colors. And it turns out Blue Label is the high end one. And she never knew this. You know, she's only ever had red, which is the lowest, and black, which is the second lowest. And so we bought her a bottle of Blue Label. And it turns out in the States, it's $200 cash.
Wow.
In the United States. So, of course, it was the perfect mix of smoky and smooth. Like, you get that smoke in your mouth, mm-hmm. but then it finishes, in my opinion, it finishes very smooth. So, I don't, like, to me, I like some smokiness flavor while I hold it in my mouth, but I don't want to, like, have what I call the dragon breath, where, you know, you usually get into with the shots, you know, when you drink and you just breathe that fiery breath, like a good, mm-hmm. like a good to me, sipping just pure liquor is something I can drink, enjoy the flavor in my mouth, swallow, and kind of maybe, you know, maybe it has a little bit of a little aftertaste, that I enjoy, but it's not going to like linger in my mouth like rubbing alcohol, like I get with vodka, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, I find a good scotch when you exhale, there's usually a nice kind of, like a second breath to it.
Right, yeah. Pardon the like pun. A woody, yeah.
Yeah, so I just looked this up. Johnny Walker Blue Label. I didn't realize it was a blended scotch. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Usually single malts are the ones that get you up into the couple $100. Mm-hmm. In Canada, FYI, it's $275.
Ooh, nice.
Good old exchange. Gotta love it.
yeah. Well, you have reason to celebrate. You deserve a really nice bottle of scotch.
Thanks, yeah. Future. Yeah, I mean, it's been, like I said earlier, it's been a very good week. The Daily Paintings book, The Art of Piper Thibodeau, that I've been plugging on Kickstarter for quite some time, and the reason why I wasn't able to make the show last week, just because we had so much going on, we funded. As of yesterday, we finished the campaign at 12 p.m. Eastern, and Ooh. We finished at 133%. Funded.
Ooh.
And yeah, I mean, I'm excited. Piper is ecstatic. There's a thank you post up on the Kickstarter page, and if you go to bit.ly/dailypaintingsks, and unfortunately Bitly links are case sensitive, so there's a capital D, capital P, and then a capital KS, but anyway, or you go to forgepublishing.com and you'll link from there. Anyway, there's a little thank you from Piper, there's a thank you from me. And one thing I didn't realize is that when the Kickstarter finishes, it doesn't let you change the design of the page anymore. So in the last leg, in the last 48 hours, we had moved all the stretch goal information up to the very, very top of the page because it made sense. As people arrived, they wanted to know, oh, hey, it's funded. What are they doing next? And they don't have to scroll very far. It was all right there.
Right.
I had intended on moving that back because I knew that the Kickstarter page was going to be the home for communicating with our backers for the next couple months as we make the book. And I did not. I got caught up in the excitement of everything, and I did not go in and edit that thing because I didn't think I was going to be locked out of it. So now when you go, the first couple things you see are stretch goals, one of which we didn't get to. And then it starts into the details of what the book is and who Piper is. And so, yeah, so I'm a little disappointed in that. I might even reach out to Kickstarter and say, like, look, I want to edit this, but I don't want to do much. I just want to, or you can do it if you want. I'm just, as a designer, I'm just like, God, this looks really poor. So lesson learned, the next time I do something like this, I'm going to obviously go in there in the last 10 minutes and just remove the stuff. Because Piper and I were on Skype for like 3 hours Tuesday morning. Like we were basically ringing in the new year together, like watching the countdown.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they actually give you seconds. When it gets down to under a minute, they count it down on Kickstarter Live. It's pretty cool.
That's great. That is exciting, especially when you tie it to, in a lot of people's, very exciting dreams and goals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is a dream for Piper. I mean, if you've ever seen an Art of Pixar book, then this is the kind of thing we're going to make. It's a hardcover book. It's 140 pages plus. And I was setting up the InDesign template last night, and we've been working on the cover. So, I mean, we started poking at it before we officially funded. We really didn't want to get too into it just because both Piper and I are so busy, you know, and not to sound funny, but time is money. And, you know, we have to work on client stuff until this becomes something that we can do. And now that it's funded, and the first time around, we had 540 backers and we just crested at 40,000. So the second campaign, we decided to do 40,000 and offer a softcover book. Well, we finished with 769 backers. 59? Anyway, over 700 backers by a chunk. And we finished at just over $53,000, which was the original goal the first time out, which is awesome because it allowed us to put in a nicer cover to the book. The other stretch goal was an otter print. The otter space print that we've been using for the marketing for the campaign, that print is going to go out to backers. And the only way that people were able to get that is if they were a Kickstarter backer. Signed and numbered book plates, which is great because the way that this Kickstarter works, Piper is not really going to be able to sign the books unless you happen to catch her in person at a convention. So with the book plates, what we can do is get these book plates shipped to Piper because they're small, they're thin, they're light and easy to ship. Get her to sign and number them all and then ship them back to Dave and he'll send them out with the books.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. Also, the other thing, for protection, the books are shrink-wrapped right from the printer. So it would be impossible to like it. Well, and it would also remove that newness of like, you're kickstarting a book and you're paying for it. You want it to be, you know, wrapped in plastic when arrived and have all your stuff next to it and things like that.
Sure.
If it wasn't wrapped in plastic, I'd be asking Dave to slide the prints and slide the stuff inside the book to keep them flat, but everything's going to be shipped in boxes. So it should be fine. And last but not least, our note cards. That was the final stretch goal. And that kind of came in overnight. Like, I was staying up really late on Monday night because we were almost at 50,000 and that was the book plate goal. And then we had another $3,000 to do and we've been averaging around 2,000, 2,500 the last 3 days of the campaign. But we pushed through and did something like $3,100 on the last 12 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of people really wanted to support Piper and a lot of it, and I have to really kind of tip my hat to the backers. It was probably split between new backers coming on board and current backers just increasing their pledge. You know, it was really cool. I mean, you've got, you know, you're paying for a hardcover book and then you're like, well, we're almost at that goal. And a number of people just kind of thought, well, if I pick it up an extra print for $15 or if I buy the, you know, the sticker pack for $5, then that just contributes and gets everybody closer to goal. And a lot of people did that. And
that's great.
Yeah. So I'm glad that we've got these add-ons. They all look great. I mean, it's all Piper's art. It looks fantastic on everything that you put it on. So my task now is to lay out the book. So the Kickstarter updates are not going to be as frequent. We were doing them daily. We're going to be down to probably once a week. And it could be from me and it could be from Piper. It all depends on who's been doing the most stuff on the book. So we've got that kind of stuff happening. I'm also going to be putting out the Forge newsletter probably once a month, and that'll be kind of like a summary of what's going on. So people that maybe weren't backers that don't need all the detail information, but want to kind of know in general where we're going with things, that's what's going on there. And you can sign up for that at forgepublishing.com. And if you are a backer, thank you. I'm thrilled. Piper is over the moon. And I just think it's really cool how many people came out to support an independent artist like Piper and help her make this project. You are going to be receiving a backer kit survey probably in about 3 weeks. We've got to wait for the Kickstarter funds to clear, all the credit card processing to happen. And then we obviously have to put together the survey and send it out to people. So that'll all happen. I'm shooting for having the book available to the public in November. That doesn't necessarily mean that Kickstarter backers are going to be receiving it in November, but it's going to be shipping by that point. The whole goal of everything this year with Piper was to make sure that this book arrives to people before Christmas. Like, that was the goal. So we are definitely going to be making the best book we can if that kind of pushes things back. So be it. But I have a convention to be at the first week of November. I'm going to be at HalCon. I'm moderating a couple of panels and I've got a table there. So it would be, my goal has always been to have, you know, Piper's new book and Forge Publishing available at HalCon to talk to people and help promote everything. So that's the plan. I'm stoked. I'm really excited to lay out Piper's book and her art is just so fun. Like I did a couple of test pages last night and it's just enjoyable to just take some of her cute art and line it up on a page and like it, you know, and I get to revisit everything, you know, that I've seen over the years, but then maybe not remembered and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think it's gonna be a great book. We're working for something that's gonna be really nice to hold and really nice to read and enjoy. So, and thank you for backing the project. I appreciate it.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations. I did enjoy them, the daily paintings. I showed Laura several of them, and one of my, again, Adam Cobb, two name drops for him. When sharing the Kickstarter, was like, what's this, you know? So hopefully he was able to contribute, but if not, like, definitely people were intrigued and wanted to know more about Piper and her work and stuff. I know her Pokemon things. I shared a few of those too because quite a few of my friends were into the Pokemon Go, so they were very interested in those as well. So it's been really cool. It's been really cool to see the whole journey and stuff like that. And this is the only Kickstarter that I've known poor people involved in it and have also and have more knowledge of it in general, because I know several people who've done like some films and kickstarted some projects that way, but I guess I don't know Piper personally, but I know at least 50% of the whole operation. It seems very congratulations.
Thanks, man. Yeah, cheers. No, we're excited. So and I took some time I think over the weekend, but there was a kind of this lull between like the there's the 10 days left and there's that initial push, but then there's like, you're going to get heavy into it like the 3, 2, 1 days. But on the fifth day, like I ended up with an evening where I actually had some time. So I watched Warcraft, the movie that came out about Blizzard's World of Warcraft in the early days of the lore. And have you seen it? Did you go see it in theaters?
No. Honestly, the sad part is... Warcraft I could have seen without Laura, but I had a long list of Ghostbusters, Star Trek Beyond, and Suicide Squad, which were all movies that Laura had a vague interest in. And because she is actively pulling down 13 to 15 hour days with the day job and her theater company, I did not want to rub salt in the wound by being like, hey, I saw, you know, in the past I've seen movies during, obviously, when she's doing all this other work. And it's you know, I know she doesn't mind, but it is kind of a bummer when, you know, you come home and your partner's seen like 85% of the movies that you kind of wanted to see. And you don't want to like force the other person to see it again, which I'm totally cool with seeing most things again. But I have not seen... I've seen Warcraft. I think literally the last thing I saw in theaters was so long ago. I'm blanking. Oh my God. Was it Civil War?
Did you see Ghostbusters?
No, we didn't get to see Ghostbusters. Oh, wow. I really, really, really want Ghostbusters is my number one. And then Star Trek Beyond, my number two, and Suicide Squad for a sick fascination, which Adam Cobb, ding, 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 finish your drink. Adam Cobb mentioned again, told me his opinion of Suicide Squad was that he liked it even less than Batman Superman. So that's the one that's the lowest on my list.
Yeah,
but,
that's a low blow. I've not heard great things about Suicide Squad either. I do want to see it, but I'm kind of hoping it hits Netflix or home video soon.
Right.
I enjoyed the Warcraft film, and I like World of Warcraft. Like, I mean, I've been a casual player for years, and I enjoy fantasy and swords and sorcery and, you know, orcs and trolls and all that kind of stuff. If you wanted to see World of Warcraft on film, that's not what you get. You get Warcraft, which was these RTS games from 20 years ago, and they, you know, it's orcs versus humans. You know, the big green monsters are bad, and the humans are good. It's not that
racist.
Black and white. Yeah, it is. And that's actually a lot of the themes in Warcraft are based around racism and stuff. But what the movie hit on a lot of marks in that I liked that the big monsters were not monsters. I mean, they were physically crazy, you know, ape-like orcs. Like, and the World of Warcraft orcs are like two heads taller than the average human and twice as wide. Like, they're just ginormous.
Thick, very thick.
Yeah, they don't, if you think about like Lord of the Rings, they really don't even compare. Like, they're a completely different kind of orc.
Yeah.
And they looked amazing because they were all CG, you know, they had the facial acting and stuff from the actors and mocap, and everything was great. The lead guy, and I'm blanking on all the names, so I'm embarrassed, but he was a little bit too handsome. Like, he was you expect these guys to be appealing characters, but you still kind of expect these things with tusks to not be good looking. And the main orc, the one that you were supposed to side with, Frostwolf, he he was a, you can tell that it was like designed to be a very attractive orc, and you're like, nah, this is not really doing it for me.
The lady orc also looked like she was trying to be too hard to be like, you know, fan, like some level of male gaze, very much fan servicey. Let's make the female character still very attractive, even though she's and she was Paula Patton. I do know that actually.
Well, she's a hybrid, but they didn't do a very good job of explaining that either. Mm-hmm. So, Frostwolf's wife, why am I not remember his last name or his first name? It's I just played the game. Anyway, I'm blanking on this. It's a good thing I don't have it linked to IMDb, which I do. I can look that up right now.
I'm on the page.
But the actual orc females are actually pretty cool looking. They're pretty beefy. You know, they don't look like waifs. They're all warriors. Khadgar Durotan. Durotan is his name.
Durotan's the main dudes.
Durotan's the main guy. Yeah, that's
Human or orc.
Yeah, okay. Durotan is the orc, and then Khadgar is a guy, but Orgrim is another orc. Blackhand's an orc. Gul'dan's an orc. Anyway, the acting from the orcs and stuff steals the show. Like you're not looking at these things thinking like, "Ooh, cool! This is really cool CG work." Mm-hmm. It's as immersive as Avatar was from James Cameron.
Yeah,
like you just completely forget the world building in it is great when they're outside. Unfortunately, when you're in Azeroth, when you're with the humans, maybe because the humans are real people, or filmed, or maybe because every backdrop in this thing, when you're in Stormwind, is a giant green screen, and it's just like everything. Like it just the guy walks in, and it looks like it would be a really nice sci-fi TV show.
I was about to say, Sci-Fi Channel does this all the time. Every set is just green screen. Yeah,
it's brutal, and it does not work at all. And the other thing about the humans that really kind of dropped the ball for me was one of the lead actors, he's from the show Vikings.
Oh, Travis Fimmel?
I think that's him.
Is he Lothar?
Yeah. So Lothar is great. And he's got this great accent and stuff like that. And even Khadgar, I think, has got an accent. But then one of Khadgar's lackeys, like one of his other mage friends, is played by an American actor that was in Battlestar Galactica. And he doesn't even fake a British accent. Like he just walks on talking like he's from, you know, the US. And it completely sucks you out of it. Now, I don't know what it is about fantasy movies that we all want them to have English accents. I think it's because that part of the world, as far as civilization goes, in that kind of stuff with castles and development and cities, is older than North America. So when when you think old world stuff, you think about Germany and France and England.
Right,
and,
that's where the Germanic traditions. Like that's the reason why we see so many of those. The castles with the, you know, your portcullises and your certain, you know, it's capital. Yeah, like the Rook, the perfect little picture of that stuff. All that is that very Germanic, European look to things. And, I mean, you go to Game of Thrones, like, it makes sense that a lot of them have British accents because, again, it looks, our idea of fantasy comes a lot from that sort of look. Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, I mean, the other stuff, the fight scenes, when a human jumps on a griffin and flies away, like, I mean, all of that sold. It was perfect. Whenever they're outside, it was great. It was the inside stuff. Because I think what they didn't do is they didn't do what Lord of the Rings does. They didn't build like a three-quarter set or a half set, something to have like a banister or like they had stairs, but like they didn't really get enough stuff in the scene to pick up the light from the filming. Everything to make it feel like a small space with a backdrop opening up behind it. It was just all open. Like the throne room was big and open. The mage tower was big and open, and it didn't have to be. Like they could have been a lot more intimate, and I think that would have helped. And the acting was okay from the people, but the orcs really stole the show for me. I'm curious to see if it was enough of a success that they do another one, because I think they could do better.
Isn't it? I thought it was like a massive. And last time I was on the show, pardon me, your other guest had just seen. I mean, it's been enough of a success worldwide to at least merit maybe, I don't know, maybe they don't do direct to DVD, it seems like, anymore. Maybe they'll do like, maybe Netflix. Netflix always seems to swoop in and help these places, these, you know, franchises get more stuff. Maybe Netflix will do like
it would. I mean, it would be fantastic as like an 8-episode. Because that was the other thing, is that the plot itself made sense.
One of the orcs versus humans.
Orcs versus humans. One of the human mages turns bad and is the reason for this, like for some of the downfall. And these, there's the, this fell corrupt magic that feeds on death, and that's, I mean, it's all precursor to the Burning Legion and demons, and one of the major plots in World of Warcraft. And there, I mean, the expansion is coming out in just under a week, and that's the, that's Legion. So I mean, it's all tied in there, but the very very early seeds. And there's a relationship between Lothar and this hybrid orc, the half woman, half human, half orc. I think there's a father-son relationship between Lothar and his son as well. There's also a father-son thing happening with the king and his son. And his son is actually one of the current kings in World of Warcraft. So, I mean, we're dealing with like about a generation, you know, between. And they're just like it. I understood what they were trying to do, but there wasn't enough screen time and there wasn't enough just time spent together for what appeared to be lovey-dovey eyes happening between Lothar and the orc to make any sense. Like, he was like, these guys have been hanging out for like to you, it felt like they've been hanging out for the same amount of time that you've been watching the movie, which is about 2 hours. You know, and he's like, this does not make any sense. So it was very much like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. It's like, well, nothing is like, no time has passed. And I think they would have done better. It's one of those movies where I think it would have been better if it was longer. And and I think it would be, given how deep Warcraft lore is, and how much they have to cover, I think it would probably be something better done as just a really big budget show. Like, I guess the competition there is that no one wants to try to be Game of Thrones. But arguably Game of Thrones, they've only gotten into some CG dragons in the last like year. with Warcraft, if they did a TV series, like a live action TV series, they could probably do a lot of really cool stuff and have it look fantastic. And I mean, if they did it in chunks, like, you know, like 6 to 8 episodes on Netflix, I think that would be fantastic.
That would work out. One of the big things I was worried about is all the things I'm interested in, minus the humans. I mean, I'm a sucker. When I always make human D&D characters, people are always like, "That's lame." It's like, but that's what I am. but I've never, ever, 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 ever been interested in the orcs from the World of Warcraft stuff. I mean, like, I know naturally, like, the alliance is filled with, like, you know, your hand-wringing corrupt people, and sure, the orcs, you know, have some evil ties or whatever like that, but I've never been interested in them. But I am interested in the Tauren, because I love me some Minotaur man, and I do love not the gnomes, I like the dwarves, and they're like buckshot things and stuff like that. So like, I knew going into this, like, I watching all the previews and all the stuff, I was like, two of the things I'm most interested in aren't even in it. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not interested, super interested in night elves. I mean, whatever, you know.
There was elves in it and there was dwarves in it, not for very long. They're more a part of a council, but they show them, and they did a great job on the dwarves. Now those guys were CG too.
Oh, interesting. Because they didn't full makeup.
No, because the dwarves in Warcraft are, again, it's like the reverse of an orc. It's their heads are huge, and their stature is much shorter than a human, but they're also a lot wider than a human too.
Yeah.
And they're not like stumpy legged. Like, they're smaller, stocky people. So like, it didn't make sense to cast short actors or do the camera trick like they did with John Rhys-Davies in Lord of the Rings. Like, they just went CG, and it worked out great, because like, the guy, their noses are bigger than normal people's noses. Like, I mean, everything about them is really stout. And it worked. And it, like, again, like, it, you never questioned it. And I'm just wondering, if they could have done the whole thing and just done CG for the people, if it would have made, because I mean, like, really, you're down to like a half dozen characters that are humans.
It just seems like Blizzard's made so many amazing, I know Blizzard didn't do the effects for this thing,
they do,
like,
now
through
their trailers.
But that's the thing, it's like you watch those trailers, they're gorgeous, and I know you've been talking a lot about the Overwatch shorts and stuff like that, and like that art is so good. Like, nobody out of Pixar to me has done, that's not true, I mean there has been really great CGI work when it's really dedicated and stuff like that, but it's just so weird to me. Like, I get it, you know, it's on the big screen, so, and it's an epic, so it'd be weird to pitch like a CGI epic because we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, Final Fantasy Spirits Within is like way past now, and if you go back and watch it, like, it feels like something that could maybe have a bit more success nowadays, but I still don't think we're there yet. I think superheroes mm-hmm. have proven that we like splashy characters, but still grounded, quote unquote, in reality by having fleshed out human beings. Even though you watch a Spider-Man movie, that's all CGI Spider-Man. Like, unless he's standing still for the most part, you know. Yeah. So, I don't get why we can't just replace some of them. But, you know, even coming from an acting background, I'm like, I'm torn between the two things because it's like, get real people. But mocap's come so far, and Andy Serkis has proved, like, damn, that man alone just deserves an Oscar because he doesn't get enough credit for how great an actor he is for not even technically being on camera. But
yeah, and I would love to see, I mean, when the DVD comes out for Warcraft, like, I would love to see the behind the scenes stuff, because I'm sure it's just as much work on the people that played, you know, Lothar and mm-hmm. the humans as it was for Durotan and Orgrim and the other ones. And that's the thing, like, the guy that played Durotan, Toby Kebbell, he doesn't even have a very aggressive voice. He was a pretty soft-spoken guy. Whereas Clancy Brown plays Blackhand, who at the time is the war chief. And, like, it's perfect. You hear his voice and you just immediately go, I know that guy.
Yeah.
And I know that he's bad. Like, he just has that weight to it, right?
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that I wish they had done a little bit more of. Even Gul'dan, I wasn't I wasn't a fan of the guy that did the voice for Gul'dan. I thought Gul'dan was supposed to be a little bit more aggressive. He was again very soft spoken for the main villain. Like, he's the warlock that's causing all this trouble, and you expect him, maybe not Darth Vader, but you expect him to be at least creepy like the Emperor, you know, and probably have a big, deep voice because he is an orc. He's still huge. He's all hunched over, but he's still a big animal, you know. But yeah, anyway, I would suggest people see it. If you're curious about it, form your own opinion. It is still entertaining. I didn't turn it off. You know, like, I was fully entertained right to the end.
When's the last movie you turned off?
Oh, that happens a lot.
really? I forget that you're somebody who can't even, like, suffered through.
Trying to remember what the last one that I turned off was. I tried to watch, there's a couple things I tried to watch on Netflix recently that I just bailed on. Well,
Netflix is easier, that's for sure. Yeah. Than getting, like, the discs and you're like, well, crap, I already paid $2 for this.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, with Netflix, I'm trying to remember what the last thing I watched that I turned off was. I remember talking about it with someone recently, and I did mention on the show, The Book of Life, the animated film, I turned
off. We talked about that. And I would love, someday we'll face off, because I disagree wholeheartedly. I love that movie.
I've been told I have to finish it. I just, Cheech started singing You Got What I Need, and I was like, I'm out, I'm done. But, gone. Good Dinosaur. That's a lie. I started watching it last night. Now, granted, I was tired.
Interesting.
But I have had all day today. I took a long breakfast this morning. I made some pancakes. Surprise, surprise. I had an opportunity to watch some stuff over dinner. I didn't. I ended up listening to a podcast. But I have no desire to go back and finish The Good Dinosaur. I thought it was dumb.
I heard it was very, like, it's quiet because, like, it came out quietly and then, like, it didn't get press. But oddly enough, like, as much as Cars and Cars 2 have been bad-mouthed, and I haven't seen Cars 2 to bad-mouth it, but Good Dinosaur seems to be, like, the skeleton in the closet of the Pixar wardrobe where people are just like, no. I mean, like, it's so, I guess it's so boring that it's not good. Like, it's not god awful. It's just not interesting.
Yeah, it's not interesting at all. It's really gimmicky. Like, I mean, I watched the first, I don't know, 20 or 30 minutes of it, and the premise is neat. You know, the asteroid misses the Earth, so then dinosaurs don't get wiped out, which means that humans and dinosaurs are going to live together. The human that I've seen in the movie so far is essentially a dog. That's what it is. He walks around on all fours. He scratches behind his ears with his feet. Like, I mean, it's a caricature of a dog, just CG'd as a human. But all the dinosaurs are farmers, and they use their heads to plow the field, and they grow corn. They plant seeds. They talk like Kansas hicks. Like, it's not appealing. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you're like, I'm watching this, and I'm kind of going like, would somebody from Kansas get offended if they watched this? Like, it's not, you know, it's not overly sensitive to that kind of stuff. And the dinosaur designs, they look like Dino from the Flintstones.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know?
Whereas you want some prehistoric cartoons, go watch Ice Age. Those movies are fantastic and funny. Oh, and the character designs are good, you know?
This is so interesting to me that you turned up Book of Life. I suffered through the first Ice Age and said never again with this god-awful Ray Romano, Dennis Leary, John Leguizamo, like, all in their own rights, very funny, very interesting comedians, but they absolutely define what I don't like about the CGI craze when it exploded after like Toy Story 2,
yeah,
which was like,
I agree with you there.
Grab some people who are funny, throw together a script, and we'll make something. Like, yeah.
The exception to that would be Kung Fu Panda. Those are great movies.
The very first one I actually enjoyed, but again, it's like, it's very, very hard. Toy Story franchise was the only franchise I've seen a CGI sequel to that I was like, oh, wow.
I liked Kung Fu Panda 2. I haven't seen 3. I shouldn't say the whole. Okay. I shouldn't say I love all 3, but I like the first two. I certainly remember enjoying the villain from the second one, the crane. I thought that was really cool.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about what other series there might have been that I liked. So Kung Fu Panda, How to Train Your Dragon, they're good, but they're not.
Oh, I haven't seen
no,
the second.
But that's not laced with like famous actors either, right? Like, they just kind of
true.
You know, yeah. That's not part
Shrek.
Of the gimmick.
Shrek is really the
Shrek is the one that started it all. Yeah. And there was another one. Things like Monsters. No, what's it called?
Monsters Inc.
No, not Monsters Inc. It's another DreamWorks picture.
DreamWorks one.
Yeah, you know, there are the 50
Hotel Transylvania.
Nope, that's Sony, I think. The 50-foot woman, the blob, the mad scientist.
Oh, Aliens versus Monsters?
That's what it is, right. It's a really dumb name for a movie, but it's a decent movie.
And I think I heard that was solid.
Yeah, yeah, but it also has, like, the guy from House, and it's got, I think it's Reese Witherspoon. They've got all the, like, some big actors in there, and it's...
Right.
Seth Rogen's in it. Like, as soon as the blob opens up his mouth, you're like, it's Seth Rogen. You know,
so Rainn stuff Wilson. Like, okay, yeah.
So stuff like that is, it skirts the line where, like, it's part of that trend, but it's still a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I like when they do more original stuff. Like, for example, like you're watching Good Dinosaur, and my mind is saying, like, these are the same people that made Inside Out. Like, Inside Out is a beautiful film.
Yeah, it's very good.
And original, and just all this stuff. And the only reason I kept watching The Good Dinosaur is because the environments are stunning. Like, whatever they're doing technically in that movie is awesome. But, like, so far the plot's kind of telegraphed. You kind of know how it's going to go. And I mean, I say that, I think, about a lot of animated films. I think, unfortunately, they're getting a little bit simple, but Inside Out, I really enjoy that.
Right.
The original plot, stuff like that. Like, I couldn't guess how that was going to end.
That's true. I think that's a fair point to make about the Pixars. In the past, I would say the ones that, in my opinion, rise above the rest were the ones that you couldn't really figure out. Like, it was very surprising the way WALL-E was structured with the silence of so much of the film, which to me is the best act of the film, is actually the first act, with some transitioning. But yeah, like Monster Originals, Monsters, Inc., very high concept, very extremely high concept. And it is anchored by two extremely big voice actors, to be fair. Pixar is not, you know, doesn't shy away from big names. But like a movie that I thought was good but not great was Megamind. And it was Will Ferrell and Brad Pitt and Tina Fey. And I was like, Tina Fey did a good job. Brad Pitt can't. It's just not interesting at all. Like,
not as a voice actor, no.
No, not at all. Like, there are plenty of extremely charismatic people that can still translate that to their voice. And then there are people who just can't do that. And that is Brad Pitt in a nutshell. Like, I don't know if George Clooney's done voice acting, but he's another guy that I'd be very interested to see if you just completely remove like his smirk and the way he presents himself and see if that would even translate. Hugh Jackman's one, I watched Flushed Away, and he did a great job. I thought that one was pretty good. I think that was Hugh Jackman and Kate Winslet. And I thought that one was fun, and that was one of the few where I was like, okay, you know, we've got some fancy big names here. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it. And, you know, it actually kind of came through for me. So,
yeah. And I mean, I don't like Will Ferrell. So Megamind was hard for me to watch. And, and again, like there's the difference there is like Billy Crystal is a huge name, but 2 minutes into Monsters, Inc., you're not thinking about Billy Crystal. You're thinking about Wazowski, right?
He's lost. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But with Megamind, you're still picturing Will Ferrell in a sound booth. Mm-hmm. Right, like it just it's a little bit too similar,
right?
And maybe that's because Wazowski has, I'm not sure whether Crystal changes his voice at all for that, but he's definitely a higher energy and higher octave. Like he just doesn't sound as dry as Crystal does,
right? You know, exactly.
Like if you see Crystal doing stand up, he's not like jumping around on stage, whereas Wazowski tends to be a little bit more animated.
Right. The way rest in peace Robin Williams, like you could see you could feel his energy through his voices, and to a vast degree I feel like no matter what he still translates. I mean, the genie from the first Aladdin hands down is still one of probably the top five most interesting characters animated, just the way like man, he just enlivened that character so much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. It's interesting. And again, I'm making myself pretty much hypocritical. I'm sure plenty of people are like, well, Toy Story is anchored by Tom Hanks, and if there's not a bigger name in the world. Well, the funniest thing is when that first Toy Story movie came out, and of course, like this is before CGI was a thing, like I remember watching that with my parents and just being like, that was really great. That was interesting. And then as we started to figure out all the names that were in it, all the way down to Jim Varney, better known as Ernest, and Annie Potts, and you go to, God, the guy who's in all the Pixar movies who played Cliff on Cheers.
Yeah, I know who you mean. I just can't remember his name right now.
Ratzenberger,
yeah.
I think, yeah. And then... you know, you just got this long line. Oh, yeah, and Don Rickles, all these different people. And then, you know, Tim Allen and like just this long line list of like of named, you know, even to some degree, like Don Rickles, like a working class comedian who may or may not still be in the pop culture, whatever. But like Tom Hanks, Tom Hanks is so Tom Hanks in everything he does that part of his shtick is that he's an everyman, but Woody, when he is Woody, he's Woody. I mean, it's just Woody. Mm-hmm. Like, it's amazing. So, yeah, it's the same way like Ellen DeGeneres is Dory. Like, you close your eyes, you immediately can picture Ellen DeGeneres doing it, but when Pixar puts Dory and her voice together, it's lost. You just lose them. And that's a really interesting part of the merging of the acting and the animation.
Yeah. Have you seen Fantastic Mr. Fox?
I have. Oh, so that's Clooney. Clooney is in that.
Sam just putting that out in the chat room.
Oh, I liked Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think it was, I had so extremely low expectations for Wes Anderson. You know, I'm a slight Wes Anderson defender to a point where that point ends when somebody makes a parody of Wes Anderson, and I find it almost as funny as Wes Anderson itself, because there was this one bit that I think it was Ed Norton on SNL, and it's they even got Alec Baldwin to do the narration. It's essentially like a Halloween like with Michael Myers like murdering people, mm-hmm. but it's done as Wes Anderson. So like the murderer is like very hokey and has like a little scrapbook of his murders, and like the phone rings and like, and it zooms into the phone and everything's in yellows and stuff. But it's like, but it's a mass murderer, and it's like, yeah, his niche is so niche that like when you literally just don't let him write it and just take his aesthetic and throw it on something, it's incredibly ridiculously overly complicated, and it's hilarious when it's done that way. So I think for that reason, Fantastic Mr. Fox, I was like, I liked it. I don't think it's even my top five Wes Andersons, but yeah, Clooney. I mean, I remember Clooney as Mr. Fox himself was good. Bill Murray in it as I think the Badger was really great. But I mean, Bill Murray is just one of those guys that I think normally I'm always going to give him a pass. Everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen the Garfields, but you know, to almost every degree, Bill Murray, yeah, can't do any wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm speaking about all this animation. I watched the Last Bastion, mm-hmm. which is one of the Overwatch shorts that Blizzard's put out. And it's easy. It's a short watch. It's only like 6 or 8 minutes. But just like earlier in the year when we were talking about the Overwatch shorts here and how good they are, this one just takes it to another level. Mm-hmm. It's in the vein of like a classic animated short, in that there's no dialogue in the whole thing. There's sound effects and there's music and stuff. But Bastion is a former War Machine robot that's been out of commission and then gets woken up by a little bird. And he's not immune to PTSD episodes. So there's some moments in the short that are pretty, I don't want to say disturbing, but they're definitely emotional on a bunch of different levels. Mm-hmm. And worth checking out. Even if you don't play Overwatch, even if you're not a gamer at all, I would say check out these Overwatch shorts. If you like Pixar stuff and you're jonesing for some really cool world building and some interesting story and some great animation, then I would check out The Last Bastion. You can find that on, I think it's Play Overwatch on YouTube, but if you just go to the Blizzard, if you just search for The Last Bastion on YouTube, you'll find it, and then linked on the side, you'll find the other shorts. I think there's 6 in total now? Or 4? I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Winston, Tracer, there's a Soldier 66, and Bastion. So there may only be 4, including, well, 4 plus the reveal.
The reveal with the kids.
Yeah, with the kids in the museum.
Yeah.
So there might be 5 total, but they're all worth checking out. And actually, there's some comics that go along with them. We were talking about the comics for Warcraft on Comics Coast to Coast a couple of weeks ago, and there's an app, and it's called Make. Not it's a Motion app. Make app. I've got it on my iPad, but my iPad is out of reach. I can't remember what it's called. But anyway, it's a really neat way of reading comics because it's not like a panel by panel. It's a portion by portion. So WoW comics app. I'm just going to see if I can find it really quickly here. So what it does is that you swipe as you're going through Madefire. That's the name of it. You're reading the book, and if you've got a panel where there's 2 people talking and the second person is coming in to the panel, you'll swipe and you'll see the first person in the panel, and then you swipe again and you'll see the second person come in with their speech balloon. Then you'll swipe a third time and you'll see the other person reply with their speech balloon. And if that's the end of that panel, then when you swipe again, you start on the next and go on and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this really cool way of pacing the reading. So like as more action happens, you have to tap the screen more often because the speech balloons are shorter, right? Whereas if it's mm-hmm. a long kind of setup scene, it's usually just some, you know, a picture of a serene valley and some text over top of it that says, you know, once upon a time or whatever. But they also have music, which is really cool. And I find that really kind of sets the scene. Now there's no sound effects and there's no voiceovers, which is fine. But there might be explosions, but there's not sound effects for everything. It would be only like really key things.
Mm-hmm.
But Overwatch has got comics in the same way. And I read the first one, but I read it on a PDF, and I want to go back and check them out with some music and stuff behind it, because I really think they've got some cool world building happening. And what the characters that they have not covered in the shorts, I know that they've touched on in the comics. I love it for a first-person shooter game, which is just bizarre to me. I think it's great, but it's like so much story for a game where you don't get any story.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, that's, but then, you know, the card series Magic the Gathering has for years had a concurrent storyline supposedly going through it. And I used to read the books for certain ones of them.
Oh, yeah?
Which is why I have an absolute love of airships. And barbarians, two of my big fantasy things. It's supposedly now they don't do books anymore, but you can kind of, there was always flavor text, so that would in the paintings and the theme would kind of lead you towards a story thing. But apparently, online and on websites and stuff like that from Wizards of the Coast, you can kind of get information through there. But yeah, it's just interesting stuff like that when you find out that something you love that's essentially just sort of pick up and drop has such a deeper well of stuff, which to me, in a lot of ways, I think those games don't get enough credit, because once you find something so simple and easy to do and enjoy, and if you dig it and really love it, then you should have the depth to get into it. It's the difference between those video games you might play. I feel BioWare does this really well with the Mass Effect series, and to a slightly lesser degree, Dragon Age, where they would in Mass Effect, if you love this world, there's 1,000 codex entries about every single thing you could want to.
Right.
And other than the annoying notification that you have a new codex entry, there's nothing that would alert you to the fact that you're missing out on quote unquote depth of story, because you can just bulldoze through the game and play and just get the main storyline. You don't even have to do side quests. Again, it's you kind of choose your own amount of richness to it. And those sort of things to me are so much more interesting than the ones where, Square Enix is starting to change it a little bit, but the problem with some of the early Final Fantasies when I get into them is you really have to go through so many cutscenes and so many different sometimes text scrolls and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, you're just kind of look, I kind of came to play this game. I know text-based adventures was one of the early forms of video games, but look, I'm not interested in that anymore.
Yeah.
I found a good way to continue to read outside of my video game. So,
yeah. I find the same thing now with Warcraft. Now that there's some of the quests, the major quests and major events will have voiceover NPCs, so they'll explain to you what's happening and why you have to do it and how important it is, and it's a lot more emotional when you've got a voice actor behind that.
Oh, totally.
But then the next quest after that, or another big quest that you thought you were going to get more voiceover dialogue, and you got to read it in the chat window, and it's like, well, this is really not at all, because the text for the person, you're looking at the person and they're doing the same emote animation over and over again. They put their hands up in the air and they shake them,
yeah,
and then they put their hands down by their sides. And then they put their hands up in the air and they shake them and they put them down by their sides. Now, he could be telling you this soft story about him, his friend as a young boy, and he's doing the same, handshake up and down, he's like, this doesn't make any sense. And then, but the whole time, you're not really looking at him anyway, because you've got to read the text, which is way over in the corner. If you're going to make me read what he's saying, at least put it above his head or in a caption, a closed caption thing. Anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, there's some issues that go back and forth with that kind of stuff. Have you been reading any comics at all? Anything good old fashioned paper comics or digital comics?
I don't do hardly any, of the physical comics, but one of the things that I realized when I was trying to think of things I've been enjoying recently, one of the things I'd actually finally caught up on was I got 3 new trades of Sixth Gun, which is by Colin Bunn and Brian Hurt. Colin Bunn being the author or writer, I should say, and Brian Hurt being the inker, and then Bill Crabtree, because the colors are also vibrant. And colorists and inkers really and truly don't get as much credit as they should, although they're finally starting to get on the fronts of books and stuff. It's a really fun series. It's an occult Western. I think even going back in time, I may have talked about this on the show way, way back in the day, but there's almost like, I think there's 8 trades now. And it was one of the very first series when I briefly had my dip into getting weekly issues that I heard about it on iFanboy, and I was like, okay, there's 3 issues out. I'm going to go buy them. And I put them in the little boards, although the place provided them, so that was really easy. And I still actually have them behind me. And since then, I haven't bought the first trade or the first 2 trades, although part of me like hates actually having single issues. Like I reread it when I got the new trade so I could just go from the very beginning all the way up to what I now had, which was like through 8 trades. I guess roughly about probably 68 issues or so. But going through the single issues was a little irritating because I was just like, okay, now put this back and then pull this other thing. Whereas like the trades themselves, you know, you go through about 5 to 6 issues in there. It's really fun. Okay, it's actually pretty dark. It's not necessarily like I would say an all ages book. It's certainly not an all ages book. It's you know, probably as early as like preteen, because it's not particularly gross. It's not sexualized and there's no swearing, but it's still very like foreboding. Like there's snake cults and there's, mm-hmm. you know, priests that are supposed to be doing the will of God and protecting these 6 guns, which have the power to pretty much bring around the apocalypse, which is very biblical because of Gabriel's, you know, his horn, and if you blow it 6 times, it brings about the end of days and all this sort of stuff. And there's no like pseudo religion, like there's no like Satan and there's no like real like God figure, any sort of stuff. It's not as deep as like the philosophicalness of like a preacher, you know, by Garth Ennis or that sort of thing. But like this is, it's just like a fun occult Western. Like the main guy, Drake Sinclair and Becky Moncrief, they're just kind of bumbling about the Wild West, which starts off kind of like, I feel like, really good mixed genres where it's very grounded in one genre, the Western, and you add just one small wrinkle, which is these magical guns, and then then there's like weird people. And I think it's not until issue 4 of the series that like this weird like storm spirit comes down and tries to like scare them out of a canyon, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, those exist. And so by the 8th trade, like they've come across wendigos and they've come across snake cults and they've come across like, you know, like underground bunkers of like things, you know, you have all these different things, but you earn it by like slowly introducing new elements, revealing more of the quote unquote map of this world. And it's a really diverse, interesting cast of characters. I'm already predisposed to like Westerns, but I have always liked Westerns mixed with something, and in this case the occult worked really well. And I've just recently been on a huge, like, if you can slip in a little bit of like Lovecraftianness to stuff, like right now, like it's, yeah, I'm totally digging it. And that's sort of what we have with 6 Guns, so it's really cool. I'm interested with an artist like you, do you tend to like more the Alex Ross's, some of the people who try to like do more pseudo-realistic drawings, or do you really skew towards the Scotty Youngs, which are like completely like sort of oddball, screwball looks? Although, I mean, in all, this is generalized, but I know Scotty Young can definitely draw like real life. But like, you know, the very stylized version of stuff, or the very realistic, or where do you tend to skew on your scale when it comes to like comics?
It's funny because I like Alex Ross and I like Scotty Young. So I think
if, I do
if,
too.
If,
I
if,
do
it's,
too.
If it's done well, then I'll like land it, kind of on a lot of different art styles. I find that what I appreciate within a book especially is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So something that I find I don't like about digital comics, in depending on how you're reading them, is when they're not created with digital in mind, they're created with print in mind, but you're reading things panel by panel in whatever app you're in. Sometimes figures that are no bigger than like the tip of your thumb are full screen on your iPad. And that to me is weird. It's jarring. It's like, oh wow, that's a really not a great drawing. And then you're like, yeah, wait a minute. Yeah. But then when I look at it as an artist, like, wait a minute. I bet this is like one of the tiniest panels on the whole page. And sure enough, the whole thing is like, you know, 2 inches square. It's like, well, that's why that would be very hard to draw.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that small. So stuff like that. But for style wise, like I'm not a fan of something when like Jim Lee all the time. I find it kind of what's the word? I can't knock the draftsmanship. I mean, like,
right.
He's a phenomenal artist, but everybody starts to look the same.
Yeah. You
know, like Batman and Superman without their masks on.
Oh, they're exactly the same.
You know, like, it's the same kind of structure. I find that a lot of times they don't differentiate in terms of body types and stuff with the female characters in the comic books, like that kind of stuff. And so I don't know whether that's an art direction decision, then they don't have a choice, or whether that's just the way that they draw stuff. I remember reading The Sixth Guy when it first came out. Unfortunately, I didn't keep up with it, but I did really like it. I just didn't have the budget for more comics. And now that it's been out long enough, it's the kind of thing that I would want to go pick up in paperback trade and sit on my balcony and enjoy it, as opposed to reading it digitally.
Yeah, exactly, I definitely do.
I'm racking my brain for other artists that I would like, comics that I would read. I tend to appreciate more simple stuff. Like a lot of noise in comics, I find when the backgrounds are just as busy as the characters, like everything gets lost for me.
Yeah, sure.
I really enjoy Frank Cho's stuff, and he's got some fairly realistic.
Oh, I think
style
I know.
Going on. He's more of a cover artist right now. Although he's got a new book coming out. Actually. Something I really enjoy, and this will be a kind of a good mishmash of the two. You get all the energy that's in a Scotty Young drawing, and then you get all the refinement that's in an Alex Ross painting. I really like an artist, Stevan Sedgwick. I'm not pronouncing that right. He's like a Czechoslovakian, I think. And his work, I sent it to you one time over Dropbox. It's called Ravine.
Uh-huh.
And he does these painted fantasy comics. It's all about dragons and elves and warlocks and stuff like that. But he's very, very loose. Like if you look at something of his from 10 feet away and you go, wow, that looks like a really nicely rendered painting. When you get up on top of it, you can literally see the scribbles. Like it looks like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Yeah.
You know, like when he paints the light that's cresting on someone's nose, he just kind of goes... scratch, 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 and then done. And you're just kind of like, how can you walk away from that? But when you zoom out, like it looks fine.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it doesn't hide that it's a drawing, you know, which is something I really like about Scotty Young's work too. Like you look at the ink work and you know that it's a drawing despite how much life it has. And so I appreciate stuff that doesn't hide the fact that it's a drawing. So I do appreciate probably the more stylized side of things. Than I do something hyper real. Now, like, as far as comics go.
Like Sam Keith, am I getting that right? He used to do the Max. Do you know, recognize him?
Oh, yeah,
very rough. That sort of, you mean like that, where you can kind of see the artist has like really put a lot into it, that like that amount?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember liking the Max. It's really cool. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of rendering, but like that kind of stuff is really cool. I mean, it's funny, like if you go back and you look at Scotty Young's early stuff, it's very it's like very graffiti-like. It's very, it's got a lot of clean edges and a lot of, I mean, it's wacky in terms of the shape language, but it's very clean edges compared to what he does now. And I think honestly, a lot of what he does now, after seeing some videos of him draw and how much work he's got going on, I imagine a lot of it's just like deadline and speed induced.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a wonderful style. It's still something I strive to be able to let go in that way. My line is very different than someone that's got such a handle on their own style like Scotty Young. But yeah, I feel like I'm not a good guy to ask for comic book stuff because I'm not like if you ask me about comic strips, like I really enjoy Jim Borgman's work. He does Zits. With Jerry Scott.
So yeah,
like I'm really it's cartoony, but it's still realistic in terms of like how it's presented. You know, like it's got some real grounds. Like the characters have got five fingers, not three, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then you go back and you like Pearls Before Swine or Mutts, like those ones, I mean they're funny, but I don't ogle over the art. For stuff like that, I tend to gravitate towards Liberty Meadows was something that Frank Cho did as a comic strip before he got into comic books.
We've talked about this. I remember because I literally, as I looked at Trains frame show stuff, I was like, oh yeah, the sexy ladies again. I remember this guy.
Draws a lot of boobs.
I think just the way I always flip them. So not Colin Bunn, Brian Hurt, Ryan Ottley, and Tony Moore. Those guys have all put together art that I like to a very generalized degree. Reminds me a bit of the Batman the Animated Series, Bruce Tim Paul Dini universe of art, which things are very like, you know, like if you put together a rogues gallery or love character panoramas when like a book's had so many characters, you can kind of do a panorama of them. And you can do that with, if you Google image search Six Gun, there's quite a few of those. And you can look at all these diverse characters that Brian Hurt has created with Colin Bunn. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like, one's a giant 9-foot mummy, and then there's this like Cord Cantrell is just this like huge black man is just, and he's got like no eyes, he just has the slits. But then you look at Drake Sinclair with his bowler hat, you know, there's, and then the bad guys of course are all like culty and really mm-hmm. really delicious to look at. But I love that sort of stuff and those characters, and Ryan Ottley's the same with Invincible, and
yeah,
and
I say I like Invincible stuff. A lot.
Yeah. That's always really cool. So, and part of the reason why I even like your art to plug it is I really like when you do the wacky characters and stuff. I still love the panel where you have all your characters in the, you know, I think Charlie is Iron Man, and then
they're all in line for the Avengers.
Yes, and yeah. Then the one guy who's like, they're like, he's dressed like Hulk, and he's like, no, he's not dressed like Hulk, he's just a beast. Like that art, you know, you got Thor, that was all really, really cool. I loved those sort of things, and you know, I love the uniqueness of all those of the characters. You know, as you say, it's nice when you don't feel like they took model A, B, C, and D, and just kind of rehashed them depending on if they need a funny character or they need a woman.
It's something that I was flipping through the Incredibles art book for some inspiration the other day, and you get to this point where they show all the maquettes. It's a big foldout where they show all the different maquettes from the characters, and like from 10 feet away you can look at them and you pick them all out. Like there's Mr. Incredible, there's Elastigirl, there's Jack, like just
I don't know
silhouettes.
Just
from the silhouettes. Sorry, you didn't know what? You didn't know what a maquette was?
Yeah, what do you mean by maquette?
A maquette is the little physical sculpture that they make of the character. So before they take all the time to build it in CG, they'll get someone with clay to just make a little like 6 or 8 inch
tall version.
And then they would sculpt them all to scale. So if Elastigirl is a head shorter than Mr. Incredible, then they would do it like that, and then Jack mm-hmm. is a little baby. But when you line them all up on a shelf, you can look at them and just glance at each one and know immediately which character it is because they have an incredibly different silhouette. Like you stack Mr. Incredible next to Edna or Frozone, and you bing, bing, bing. Like you know who's who, you know?
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff is really important in character design, I find. And that, I mean, I have the advantage of my characters being aliens. So Charlie's the human-shaped one, and the furry tentacle one is Nigel, and then the short little one with an antenna is Sam. And I think if I remember correctly, it was Charlie was Captain America, Sam was Iron Man, Nigel was dressed up as Thor.
And then
there was the little kid had like Hulk smash 'em mitts or something. I had some other toys in there too.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
That's still what I'm sure somebody's already bought it, but someday if you have that panel around, I probably would love to throw some cash your way and get that panel. It just always stands out. I just love that.
Oh
one.
Yeah, no, it's I'm pretty sure I have it. It's we can talk about that. We can talk about that. So before we have to kind of muscle on out of here because I'm not sure when Zombies Ate My Podcast might be coming up hard on our tail. But there is one thing I wanted to mention very, very quickly before we wrap up the show in the Internet Minute. And that is this past weekend, I was over at my friend Laura's place to watch the final Tragically Hip concert from Kingston, Ontario. And I'm not a huge hip fan. I really enjoy some of their more mainstream music. But Gordon Downie, the lead singer of The Hip, has unfortunately been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And it was a huge event in Canada. The fact that they went on tour and the fact that this was the last venue on the tour, it's their hometown, and like CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, decided not to broadcast the last night of the Olympics and instead broadcast the concert.
Wow.
Which had three encores. Our prime minister was there, you know, in a hip t-shirt. Like, I just, you know.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, and he'd be about the right age too. There's a whole generation of Canadians. Like, when I think the Tragically Hip, I immediately think college. Like, that is, it's what my college roommates played too much of, you know, in college. And, you know, it's a different kind of music. It's definitely kind of a unique thing. They don't have a huge following outside of Canada. It's definitely more of a Canadian culture thing. But I got to spend, you know, an evening with friends and watch, you know, the final concert, you know, and kind of make that mental note of, like, where were you when they did the final Kingston show, right? And it was really, really cool. They projected it onto the garage in the backyard. So it was like an outdoor barbecue and an outdoor concert. It was fantastic. So if you haven't seen it, check out Tragically Hip final concert on Google. You'll find a bunch of articles about, you know, what happened and why and all that kind of stuff. But it's really cool stuff. And if you like some unique rock music, look up Tragically Hip. They've got quite a few albums. I think 14 or something.
Yeah. Yeah. They do quite... Yeah, there's a lot right here. I'm just on the Wikipedia page. Yeah, yeah. It already said 11.7 million people watched the concert. It was on radio, internet, and television. Radio, wow.
Yeah, you could have been a naval officer at sea and still tuned in. Like, it was they just said, look, this, we're Canadians everywhere. This is happening. You have a way to watch it. We will make sure that you can watch it.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that brings us into the end of the show with the Internet Minute. And I've got a quick one. It is brought to you by Patreon. Patreon.com/TheCitadelCafe is where you guys can go to help support the show. If you decide to become a patron, you'll get access to the Slack chat, which is where we all hang out in between episodes. Myself, the producers on the show, guests and co-hosts and all that kind of stuff, they're all there. So go over to Patreon.com/TheCitadelCafe and become a patron. Helps us out quite a bit, actually. My internet pick is the Tomb of Sargeras. It's another World of Warcraft thing, so stronger ties to the game. If you're not playing World of Warcraft, this may not make any sense to you. However, you will appreciate the production quality of these four audio dramas that they've put together. It's all leading up to the release of Legion, which is happening next week. But this one, there is music, there's sound effects, there's voice acting, there's narration. It's an audio drama. It's not an audio book. It's something that's really, really well done. The last time I read something like this or listened to something like this was The Rise of Darth Vader. And that had like lightsaber sounds and blaster ricochets and all kinds of cool stuff happening. Mm-hmm. So this is the same way. There's great music. There's good voice acting. And if you like just creepy fantasy stuff with demons and orcs and, you know, swords and stuff like that, then hey, you know, check it out. but it's called The Tomb of Sargeras, S-A-R-G-E-R-A-S on YouTube. And you can go to, if you just do the World of Warcraft channel on YouTube, you'll find everything. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern at thecitadelcafe.com. Our mobile audio stream is provided by alphageekradio.com, and the music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. Email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com to tell me how many mistakes I made, and find us by Twitter and Facebook with just the name of the show. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am up to online at joelduggan.com. Keep an eye out in my store for some new original art going up soon. I'm in the process of revamping some stuff. Also, forgepublishing.com is a great way to keep up to date on what's happening with Piper's new book. Where can people find you online, Brockett?
Oh, the Biggest Fan podcast. It's a Facebook group. You can join it. I don't really do a Twitter thing. I've tried to relocate my Twitter. Just don't even try and bother. And recently, I actually joined... it's been really fun. Other than Citadel Cafe, I've been able to be on some podcasts over the years. And some guys reached out to Kyle Ferguson and I, who you might recognize from a bunch of stuff he does on Twitch and with Garrett Weinzer and you know, Heroes of Storm and stuff like that. We were both reached out to be on How We Roll podcast. It's basically a podcast where most of the time they do the tabletop game Call of Cthulhu, and sometimes they dip in the Dungeons and Dragons, some other things. But they pretty much just collect people and they talk and they roll it, and then afterwards, Joel. I never got him to pronounce his last name, but I think it's pronounced Trier. Joe has edited. He heavily edits the whole thing, so it's actually like a lot of the roles and stuff are a lot like not necessarily in at least some of the shows I've listened to, but he puts in sound effects and all these other things, so it's sort of semi close to that radio drama aspect you're talking about. But the fun thing is it's role playing, so it was whoever was in the recording at that time role playing how they're going to do the certain scenarios. And in this one, I was part of one called Dockside Dogs, which is supposed to be the concurrent Call of Cthulhu storyline to Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. And it was very interesting and fun. Those guys were really welcoming. Sometimes you're on podcasts and the hosts are very stingy, like Joel Duggan, and they never let you talk and they make you feel very strange. No, sometimes they're very, very welcoming. And it was just a fun show, and they usually put those out and they kind of break them down. And I believe Joe said this one was going to end up probably being around roughly 3 episodes because they're about an hour each. And I think he said they'd come out sometime in October. But if any of that radio drama sound interests you, or the cold stuff, pretty much I was just twerking everything I said throughout the entire show towards this one, plug for a podcast I don't even do anything with. I was just guessing on, but I had a lot of fun with that. So How We Roll podcast. And normally I'd say check out Citadel Cafe, but you already have. So that's cool too.
Nice. You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.
This podcast recorded before a live internet audience. To learn how to listen and watch live, visit tunein.alphageekradio.com.